This is the Medicast, January 22nd, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 50. That's right, the Medicast has reached the ripe old age of 50. Almost 1 year old today, and I'm excited about that. We'll be having some things going on to celebrate the first anniversary of the show in coming weeks. And I just wanted to thank all of you for checking out the show. If you're a brand new listener to the Medicast, welcome to the Medicast. Stick around for a few episodes and get an idea of what the Medicast is all about. And of course, for you long-term listeners, I want to thank you for listening to the show, to supporting the show, checking out the Medicast website at medicast.com, and contributing to the show. We've gotten a lot of contributions over the last year, and I want to thank you for that. Contributions like suggestions, questions for the show, as well as comments about things I've talked about, and most importantly, corrections about things I've talked about. You know, I'm a medic just like you guys. I try to get out there and study and bone up on the things that I'm talking about, but occasionally I'm going to make a mistake just like everybody else, and I rely on you guys to call me on it and make sure you send in those corrections so that I can go back and make sure that everybody is squared away with the correct information. So I want to thank you for that. That said, let's jump in and talk a little bit about some of the listener email I got this week. First off, I want to say hi to listener Ben. He's an EMT student in Orlando, Florida, and he was just writing in to say he loves the show. Well, Ben, I appreciate that, and I want to make sure that you're getting everything you need to get out of the podcast. So keep in touch and work hard and good luck with your studies. And I get down to Orlando maybe once a year or so. So the next time I'm down that way, I'll send a message out on the podcast and maybe we can have a luncheon with some of the listeners down in that area. That would be a lot of fun. And we can maybe have a discussion and record it for the show. That would be great. I also got an email from listener Chris, and he was talking about the fact that he had checked out an article in GEMS about whether EMS providers who drive ambulances stopped for red lights and stop signs while on a call or just used a rolling stop. He was talking about the fact that he stops personally and didn't believe that the extra few seconds saved were going to make that big of a difference. In the past few weeks, one of his vehicles in his service did a rolling stop and T-boned another vehicle. Now, thankfully, the result was minor injuries, but it's important for us to understand that the old days of running screaming lights and siren to the hospital are no longer really what we need to be doing in the field, and I believe this very strongly. With all of our advanced protocols and changes in the way we handle patient care in the back of an ambulance, whether you're a BLS or an ALS provider, it's important for us to care for our patients. And one of the ways we need to do that is to make sure that we're not being unsafe in the way we operate vehicles. You guys listen to the show, you know I report on ambulance-related accidents all the time and the importance of wearing safety belts and the importance of using due caution when you drive in the ambulance. But it's important for us to understand that we need to make sure we stop at stop signs. People are driving in their cars, and you see it all the time, they're just not paying attention to anything else around them. I don't care how loud your air horn is or what kind of federal cue you've got on the front of your unit, they're not going to hear you until sometimes and often it is too late. So Chris, thanks for your comment. I really, really appreciate that. It's a great point that you made, and I think it's something that we all need to be aware of. Finally, I got an email from listener Heath. Heath's contributed to the show before. He's a member of EMS in the bar and nightclub scene, which is something that many of us probably don't think a lot about. And Heath often comes up with some things that are new in the forefront in club drugs and things like that that we may roll up on and not be aware of. One of the things that Heath pointed out this week was an upsurge in the use of formaldehyde to add to the high while smoking cigarettes or marijuana. What they basically are doing is soaking these substances in formaldehyde, creating a longer burning substance and a greater high. Of course, the problem is formaldehyde is an extremely dangerous substance and can cause a lot of health issues. Effects of the exposure, according to Heath, from the embalming fluid include bronchitis, body tissue destruction, brain damage, lung damage, impaired coordination, and inflammation and sores in the throat, nose, and esophagus. It is also extremely carcinogenic, so be careful how you handle anything that may have come in contact with formaldehyde when you're handling patients that you suspect this to be occurring in. But Heath, thank you as always. He also mentioned that he was recently involved in a scuffle with somebody outside the club he works at. And Heath, you know, hey bud, keep your head down, stay safe, and like getting stuff from you. So make sure you're watching your own back out there. If you want to get in touch with me here at the MedicCast, there's a couple of ways you can do that. First of all, you can reach me by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also visit the website at www.mediccast.com/blog. And on any of the blog posts there, you can leave a comment to what I've written down. There's been quite a few comments, so check out the site and you can click the links and see what comments others have left up on the site. If you do leave a comment, it shoots me an email, and that way I can approve it, because sometimes that gets spammed on my comments there. But when I approve it, I always leave a response to your comment there so you can check back and see what I had to say about what you said on one of my posts. Finally, I've added a voicemail line here at the MedicCast. You can reach me at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. So check out the voicemail line at 941-30-MEDIC. You can call in and leave me a voicemail, and I'll go ahead and possibly feature it here on the show. So go ahead and call in and ask your questions, and we can have a little bit of a conversation here. Well, let's jump right on into the news for tonight. Got quite a few items here. The first item is kind of disturbing to me, and I kind of jumped out at me. I know I have quite a few listeners down in South Africa, and so this article kind of leapt off the page at me. And if you're listening out there, guys, and you want to shoot me an email, I'd be interested in hearing about how this type of thing affects your particular service. It has to do with some strife in Johannesburg Emergency Management Services and their racial issues in some of their stations. And apparently there was an incident this past week where a black firefighter stabbed a white colleague after he became involved in a racially charged argument in their station. And this stabbing is caused just the capping point of apparently a huge number of racial problems that have been cropping up there recently. Racial epithets being hurled back and forth, children being told to not black children being told not to play soccer nearby because they shouldn't be playing that, along with just racial slogans, all kinds of things. And this is just something that I was wondering if this is a common occurrence or if this is just something that kind of made the news. We don't, you know, we're not immune to these problems here in the United States either. And I think that it's something, you know, we're all in this for the same thing, guys. We're all out there to save lives. We're all out there because we really care about taking care of people. So it disturbs me when we let something like this pull us apart. Yeah, we're going to have personality conflicts. That's normal. And we can act like adults and just not work with each other or stay away from each other as best as possible. But, you know, racial tensions like this, there's too much of that going on in the world. And I hate to see it when it crops up inside our own ranks. So I hope that this is something that's isolated. We are certainly, like I said, not immune to it here in U.S. EMS and fire circles. but I'd like to think that it's something that we can get a better handle on. So, have you ever had anybody jump out of the back of your ambulance while you're on an interstate? Well, two crew members in New Jersey had just that happen when a 68-year-old man jumped from the back of their moving ambulance on I-295 in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Initial reports said that he fell from the vehicle, but now they're saying that the man actually jumped voluntarily. It should be no surprise that he was being transported to a mental health facility at the time, but this is disturbing, and I'm sure it shook up the crew involved. He was not hit by any other vehicle on the road that was following them, but did sustain severe head injuries during the fall. You know, what do we do in these situations? How can you prepare when someone makes a decision to do something like jump from the back of the ambulance or decide to attack one of the other crew members? You can't prepare for something like that other than just, you know, watch your back. And in this situation, when you have a mental health patient, it's that time when you want to make sure you've got the straps cinched down and that maybe, you know, throw an extra couple of blankets on to tie them up a little bit before they get out the back door. I hate to see something like this happen. I hope that this doesn't precipitate into a lawsuit filed against the provider in the back, because quite frankly, you know, you talk to any mental health professional, when someone decides to do something like commit suicide or something impulsive like this, there's little or nothing that can be done to stop them in time if you're caught unawares. In another disturbing international EMS news story, I found a story that talked about an ambulance in Scotland that was ambushed by a gang of teenagers as they were en route to an emergency call. Apparently, they were driving down the street with their lights and siren going when a teenager stepped out in front of their unit and flagged them down. When they came to a stop, a group of the gang began pelting the ambulance with stones, and one of them actually tried to punch their way through the window. The ambulance chiefs in the area say that their staff and ambulances are now attacked roughly once a week in certain areas of their district. The latest attack came when two paramedics drove through an area known as Carrick No Hill in Scotland on their way to a 45-year-old man who had called in suffering from chest pains. They were traveling and they flashing their lights when the ambulance was forced to come to a halt, and suddenly there was a loud bang on the side of the vehicle. Well, this is just upsetting to me, and I'm sure upsetting to people in that area as well. And I don't know a good answer to this, other than perhaps they're going to have to start doing dual response with police agency and try to head off these gangs. But, you know, I can't understand why anyone would want to stop us from getting our job done. And maybe they were after drugs or supplies in the back of the ambulance. I'm just not sure. But it's disturbing to me that these attacks are happening on the frequency of once a week. That's just, you know, once a week too many. Moving on to a story that I think brings hope to all of us who have to deal with crowded emergency rooms and long wait times for beds. A Michigan system called the Oakwood Healthcare System has declared that their patients will now be seen as soon as they walk through the door, a zero wait time. They had previously promised a 30-minute wait time, but they have now moved up that schedule and say they can now guarantee that everyone who comes into the emergency department will be seen immediately when they walk through the doors by a healthcare worker. This is really a great idea, and they say that they wanted to point out that this has been a joint effort of the entire hospital, that the entire program and system is required to make this work. And I think this is important to understand. We know that the ER is just one part of the hospital. And often when they have long wait times for beds, it's not because they don't want to see the patients we're bringing them. It's because they aren't able to get those patients rapidly transferred up to the floor, the ones they have, so that they can clear up a bed for the new patients coming in. When I used to work in the ER, this was a constant problem. When nurses on the floor or in the ICU were making us wait an hour or an hour and a half to transfer a patient up there, we knew the bed was available and the bed was open and ready, but the nurse upstairs wasn't quite ready for whatever reason to take the transfer yet. Well, I applaud this system, and I it appears to be working quite well, and I hope to see something like this in all of our jurisdictions soon. It really has to be a joint effort on behalf of all of the system, and that includes EMS. We need to be respectful of hospitals that are having trouble because they're suddenly flooded with patients, and maybe look at transporting to other areas or other hospitals that might be close enough for us to feasibly do that. That's not going to work in all of our jurisdictions, but it might work in some of them. In the service that I work in, we actually have three hospitals that are about equidistant from the center of our district. And so they're local, small local hospitals, but for most of the things we have, they can handle just about anything we run into. So I applaud them. I found this article over at emsresponder.com. You can find links to this and all the other items in the news over at the show notes at medicast.com. Finally tonight, I found a story on a study talking about smoker's cough and the fact that it's a strong predictor of future lung disease or current ongoing early lung disease. The study, which came out of the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, followed young adults for 10 years to investigate factors that might predict COPD onset. More than 5,000 participants, 123 were diagnosed with COPD during the study. The results show that the presence of a chronic cough and phlegm is not an innocent symptom, but may be an early marker of airflow obstruction. Basically, this is showing that, you know, COPD is caused by smoking, and people that develop chronic coughs, chronic productive coughs from smoking, are likely to be an early onset of COPD in this patient. And it's important for us to recognize that in the field and direct this patient to appropriate care. Of course, their family physician, their ER docs and things like that may also probably be aware of this study. But remember, we are entitled to be out there and work on prevention techniques just as much as we are supposed to be out there treating the patients with current problems. And every time you point a patient towards getting treatment for something that they may need now, it saves us from having a patient that may have future problems later on. Now, does this mean that I think that when we point out that a smoker's cough is a problem and they may be developing early bronchitis and emphysema, is that going to stop them from smoking? Or are they going to seek treatment? Are they going to go out and do what they need to do? That's not going to happen in all the cases. I'm aware of that. But it behooves us as healthcare workers to be advocates for the health, general health and welfare of our entire community of patients. And if we can, if we see something like this going on, we can point out to the person that, you know what, I read a study that talked about the fact that the cough you have is an early sign of lung disease. You might want to check out with your doctor and see if that's the case, because that would be disturbing to me. You know, that's all you have to do. Maybe they seek treatment, maybe they don't, but you've gone another step in helping provide for the general welfare of the community you work in. And you may have saved yourself a call 10 years down the road. You never know. Now, COPD is a chronic disorder, which means that the patients live with this pretty much all the time. They constantly have a certain level of shortness of breath that may be exacerbated by other factors. And it is this exacerbation that we often get called on to deal with. This may especially occur when those with chronic bronchitis, where they'll have a rapid, sudden, or prolonged worsening of their symptoms, including the cough with mucus production and shortness of breath. This may be from anywhere from mild to life-threatening in nature, and it may be coupled with other things such as lung infections, pneumonia, depression, weight loss, and heart problems like chorpulmonol. It develops over many years, of course, and is most common in the elderly. It's also most often caused by smoking. In fact, nearly everyone who has COPD, 80 to 90% of them, have been a long-term smoker, and research supports that smoking has a lot to do with developing COPD. However, other things can cause it. Lung irritants inhaled over a long period of time, such as industrial dust. Also, factors like family history of COPD, low birth weight, or repeated lung infections. The most common causes of the exacerbations are lung infections, such as acute bronchitis or pneumonia, and air pollution levels. So in the summertime where we have pollution alerts, that's when you're going to see some of these problems come about, especially in the springtime with pollen and things like that causing reactions. You will see things that cause exacerbation of COPD. How are we going to treat this problem when it crops up? Well, when we treat exacerbation of COPD, if it's mild, of course, we're just going to put the patient on O2. A lot of patients are already on O2, so we want to increase that level, probably if they're on a nasal cannula with a lot of extension tubing and it's set at 2 liters per minute, they're probably not even getting a half a liter per minute. So you want to bump it up a little bit. Give them either a nasal cannula at 4 or 6 liters per minute in your unit, or possibly put them on a non-rebreather mask. Of course, you're going to want to make sure you use your pulse oximetry to obtain a baseline pulse ox level and find out what their level of hypoxia is. It's important for us to realize that although hospitals and long-term care facilities are concerned about the hypoxic drive that COPD patients develop over time, we don't need to worry about that in the field. When we're dealing with exacerbated COPD, we want to apply high-flow oxygen. Let the hospital worry about weaning them off that and getting them back to a position where they can be on low-flow oxygen on short periods for longer periods of time. In our time, transport times, it usually takes days or even weeks for patients to develop a affinity for high flow oxygen so that their respiratory drive is affected. So don't worry about that in the back of the unit. But you do want to use your pulse ox sensor. And if you have a patient with severe, moderate or to severe exacerbation of COPD, then you want to consider ALS interventions. And you're moving into the realm of looking at CPAP, looking at nebulizer treatments and things like that so that you can open up the air passages and get some of that trapped air out. And the ways to handle that are often ALS interventions. So if you're a BLS unit, get the high flow oxygen on there and make a decision whether you're going to transport straight to the hospital or whether it saves you a little bit of time to go ahead and rendezvous with somebody to get other treatments on board. And that'll be however your local protocol handles it. Now, we all see a lot of these patients repeatedly over time. And one of the reasons is that it is a chronic disorder, but it's also a progressive disorder. And while treatments in the field and treatments from the doctors to these patients are becoming more effective in handling the chronic nature of this disease, it is progressive in nature and eventually will continue to get worse, and their lung function will continue to deteriorate. And eventually, these patients may need to consider advanced directives. In fact, I think a lot of the advanced directives I run into in many cases are COPD patients who have finally realized they just don't want to be resuscitated anymore. No more intubations in the field. Eventually, in very severe COPD, as it progresses, it will develop such a problem with the tissues of the lungs that actually it causes an increased blood pressure within the pulmonary system, and that causes blood to back up into the right side of the heart. This causes an enlarged right heart ventricle, and this is cor pulmonale. And it will cause, of course, right-sided heart failure, which leads to edema in the extremities as there's a problem with blood return to the heart. When you assess these patients, you want to start with just a general impression. Do you see signs of cyanosis, bluing around the lips or the fingertips? When you're checking for cap refill, what's their circulatory status like? You also want to listen to the lungs and listen for the sounds of wheezes, of air being trapped. You know, if you get into the habit of percussing for lung sounds, especially along the back, you can hear that trapped air as it becomes hyper-resonant in those areas where the air is being trapped in lungs. You want to, of course, assess for pulse oximetry. If you have capnography ability in your unit, you can also check out for the capnography. And if you look at the waveform, you'll be able to see definitive changes in the how the waveform as the trapped air is more slowly released. So you'll see a sloped waveform there as the trapped air slowly comes out before they take their next breath. As you look at these patients, especially in severe and very severe COPD, you will notice that they tend to be thin. This is because they've been spending a lot more effort and calories working to breathe. They are really expending a lot of energy trying to tripod to keep their position so that they can expel air from their lungs in the most efficient manner. This is why CPAP works. It keeps the small airways open so that the alveoli can deflate and the air can come out. When we put CPAP on, it creates a positive pressure system, and that positive pressure helps keep those small airways open so that the trapped air can escape. There's a lot more information on this website and a lot more information out there in general on the web. I also urge you to head back and look at your protocols and review them if you haven't recently. It's something we need to do periodically, ongoing, as we are now firmly in the middle of the flu season, and we're going to see a lot more people with exacerbated COPD symptoms. With the tip and trick of the week done, it must be time for this week's Med of the Week. This week, I look at magnesium sulfate. This is one of those medications that we carry along with us, but we don't get to use very often. But it is one of those drugs that when it is needed vitally. Mag sulfate is an electrolyte, a central nervous system depressant, and an antidysrhythmia drug. And it works by reducing the striated muscle contraction and blocking peripheral neuromuscular transition by reducing acetylcholine release in the muscles. In emergency care, we use it most often to manage seizures associated with toxemia of pregnancy. So people that have eclampsia that are starting to seize because of severe high blood pressure in pregnancy, you may be in your protocol to administer mag sulfate, probably with consult, I would suspect. It also will induce uterine relaxation, and it may be used to inhibit contractions of premature labor. It may also be used to treat dysrhythmias as a result of tricyclic antidepressant overdoses or digitalis toxicity. So you want to check and see what exactly you're looking at using this for. There's been some evidence that it is helpful for refractory VFib and VTAC after the administration of lidocaine and other dysrhythmia drugs. Its onset is pretty much immediate, and it lasts in the system for about 3 to 4 hours. Of course, as I said earlier, its indications are for seizures associated with eclampsia, torsades de pointes, and hypomagnesemia, reduced magnesium levels in the blood. This is something that we'd only know if we had a lab result that would indicate this. But there are situations where we may be indicated to give this in a possible interfacility transport situation. It's contraindicated in patients with any kind of heart block, with renal disease, and with known high levels of magnesium in the blood. Adverse reactions you're likely to see. Well, CNS depression. So you're going to see a change. You may see a change in mental status. Diaphoresis, facial flushing, hypotension. So you want to make sure you're ready to maintain blood pressure. Good idea to make sure you have a line ready and a bag ready to flow when you give this medication, because it may cause a sudden onset of low blood pressure and you want to be able to get fluids in there to bring it back up. You may see a change in reflexes. The patient may complain of being cold or chilled and develop hypothermia. Also, reduced heart rate, cardiac arrest, and asystole are possible, with also a complete circulatory collapse and respiratory depression. This drug interacts with other CNS depressants and may enhance those CNS depressants if taken at the same time. You also may see serious changes in cardiac function when used with cardiac glycosides. Special considerations. For pregnancy patients, you want to make sure that it is administered to treat toxemia of pregnancy, but it's recommended that the drug not be administered in the 2 hours right before delivery, if possible. So if you think the patient's going to deliver a baby, then it's not the time to administer this medication if that's imminent. You also want to monitor for convulsions up to 48 hours after delivery, which may necessitate additional doses of this medication if they develop seizures post-delivery of the baby. Again, you want to use caution in all patients with renal problems because the MAC sulfate is cleared exclusively by the kidneys and can rapidly reach toxic levels. There's been some discussion of prophylactic use of MAG sulfate in patients with AMI, but I suspect that's not something you're likely to see in your protocols. Anyway, that's MAG sulfate in a nutshell. And again, review your own protocols, review what your statistics are and indications are for using this medication in your system. And check over at the GhettoMedic.com site for all the other meds and information that they have available over there. A link to all of this is in the show notes, as always. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you again for checking out the show. Make sure you send in your comments, your questions. If I made a mistake in here, make sure you call me on it so I can correct it in next week's episode and on the website. We want to make sure that we all have the best information available. So double check me, folks. I'm counting on you to back me up. As always, you can reach me here at podmedic@mac.com, and you can leave an email there for me. You can also reach me at the voicemail line at 941-30-MEDIC. That's 941-306-3342. Of course, you can check in at the website at medicast.com. And you can leave a comment over there on any of the blog posts that are listed. We've been getting quite a few great comments listed up there. So check in at the site and feel free to comment back and forth. Let's get a little discussion on some of the things that I post up on the website. And of course, share the show with other providers. Spread the word about the MedicCast and let people know what you're listening to and what you enjoy, whether it's this podcast or any other podcast. Let folks know what's going out there in the new media revolution that is podcasting. It's really exciting to be part of this, whether you're a listener or a podcaster like myself. I really enjoy getting this information together for you all every week. If you want to get an email update on the show, you can send me an email at podmedic@mac.com and put the word update in the subject line, and I'll add you to the email list for the show. I don't spam you on that list, and I don't spread it around to anyone else, but I do use it to let you know when new information has been posted and new episodes are posted up for you to listen to. You can probably expect to get about one email a week from me there. So if you're interested in getting that update, go ahead and shoot me a line at podmedic@mac.com and let me know you want to get the update. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This particular song comes from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. And I heard this song over at the Buckeye Drive Time podcast. So you'll hear great music like this and many others over at that podcast. And you heard the promo a little bit earlier. This song is from a band called Natives of the New Dawn, and it is a song called People. If you like what you hear, you can check out the links in the show notes to the band's website. And also, if you like to use iTunes to get your music, there are links there for you to go directly over to iTunes and download the song there if you'd like to purchase it there. As always, if you like the songs and like the music, please let the bands know you heard their music here on the MedicCast. Until next week, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene Safety, BSI.
Pay attention, for you've got to use your the result of my overly active imagination's design. You see, it's playing in my mind. It's that soundtrack to my activities. And it was in the breeze that I first heard these harmonies. And now I'm singing this song, and you can't help but sing along. No, it's just, it's one of those feelings that lets you know where you belong. Yes, it's a stone groove that's guaranteed to alter your mood. Pretty soon you'll start to realize that you're completely consumed. My people,
people!
Down on that instrument.